The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, folks. This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 9th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The 45th president of the United States is a first-timer in politics. He's the oldest person ever to be elected to a first term, and he's a billionaire named Donald J. Trump.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. Time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me.
If you watched the results unfold last night, it was a victory that ripped northern industrial states from Democratic hands, that underscored a failure, an apparent failure of Hillary Clinton to deliver a credible message on the economy, and that revealed that Trump's supposed massive shortcomings with women and minorities didn't matter all that much to enough voters in the end. Trump's critics have excoriated him for a year or more for not sounding presidential. But last night he did, because he was.
We're going to get to work immediately for the American people. And we're going to be doing a job that hopefully you will be so proud of your president. You'll be so proud. Again, it's my honor. It was an amazing evening. It's been an amazing two-year period. And I love this country. Thank you. Thank you very much.
A few words about the numbers. From Florida to North Carolina, Virginia, and Ohio, as returns came in, it became clear that Hillary Clinton was underperforming among the group she needed to offset Trump's advantage with white working class voters. A stunning overperformance in the turnout in rural America gave Trump an ace that no one, not pollsters, not the many long-winded aggregators, saw in the deck. Trump's ace was crucial in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania. Trump's closing message was simple: the economy. While Hillary Clinton's message was also simple: Trump is a dangerous incompetent who disrespects minorities and women. But that tone was not part of the concession speech that Hillary Clinton gave today. With a steely composure and a wavering voice, she ended a personal political narrative that began decades ago.
This is painful, and it will be for a long time. But I want you to remember this. Our campaign was never about one person or even one election. It was about the country we love and about building an America that's hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted.
In the end, while she won the popular vote, Hillary Clinton got fewer votes than President Obama did in 2012, 6.6 million fewer. And what's more, the Republican vote stayed about the same as in 2012. Although who voted exactly in 2016 will be the puzzle analysts will try to solve over the next weeks and months. Hillary's most powerful message today was for the heartbroken in the audience and all over America for what might have been.
And to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
Moments later, President Obama spoke about this result, surprising result, which he acknowledged was surprising, and about what impact it has on his legacy.
I also told my team today to keep their heads up, because the remarkable work that they have done day in, day out, often without a lot of fanfare, often with a lot of attention, work in agencies, work in obscure areas of policy that make government run better and make it more responsive and make it more efficient and make it more service friendly so that It's actually helping more people. That remarkable work has left the next president with a stronger, better country than the one that existed 8 years ago.
Folks, what do you think happened in this 2016 election?
This is Jillian from Ohio.
This is Matthew Meadows calling you from Seattle.
Hi, this is Karen from New Jersey.
I'm scared and I'm feeling really unsure right now.
I'm zero shocked. She rigged the primary and nobody wanted to read the emails.
I woke up this morning saddened, terrified, ashamed.
I'm not quite sure what to tell my daughter. She's nine, and this year at school she was groped and assaulted by a classmate. So I'm kind of at a loss for words today.
Monkey see no evil. Could have been Bernie.
How do I sit this morning and have breakfast with my children and explain this to them?
A takeaway from this election? One takeaway from this election? That will take some time, I'm afraid. But we can get started by hearing from you. Engagement works in this democracy. Fears, jubilation, anger, despair. I told you so, righteousness. We want to hear it. What just happened? Disorientation. All of it. Give us a call and tell us how you're feeling. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Joining me in the studio this hour is Kelly Goff, host of WNYC's Political Party and columnist at The Daily Beast. Kelly, how are you feeling?
I'm still a little surprised. I think like a lot of people I was reading the same poll numbers everyone else was, including the Republican National Committee. So I did not anticipate this outcome. I think this is going to be another reminder that every single vote counts. And, we know that 6.6 million fewer Obama voters voted this time around. We know that African-American turnout was lower in certain places like Florida, which ended up being a key decider the other evening. And as I said, I recently saw Birth of a Nation, and it's a reminder to me that a lot of people sacrificed and suffered so I could have the opportunities I do, including to vote. So how some African-Americans could not turn out is beyond me, but perhaps, a Trump presidency could be a wake-up call about why voting matters, particularly if you're from a disenfranchised group, and why protest votes can be harmful, because we know Jill Stein and Gary Johnson took quite a few votes that might have covered the spread for Hillary in a place like Florida.
Something that we'll discuss more later this hour. With me from Pennsylvania is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. You were in a state where the notion of every vote counting was an absolute reality, Todd. How did it feel?
Well, I was with a whole bunch of Trump supporters last night. I made it my business to hang out with them at their watch party. So, of course, the jubilation and triumph that I'll describe to you won't come as any surprise. There's no one profile, John, of the Trump supporter. But in a state like Pennsylvania, which is now the avatar of the white working class support that Donald Trump got, I think for a lot of people, it's about legacy. You know, when Donald Trump talks about trade and NAFTA, it's not as though every working class worker in Pennsylvania saw their job disappear to Mexico, or China. I don't think that that's necessarily the case. There is a broader sense of economic and cultural loss for a lot of people in this state. And even in their families, it may be that back in the 90s, someone's father might have lost a job when a factory moved to Mexico, or in the late 70s, certainly somebody's father or uncle or mother lost a job when the steel mill shut down. That's not to blame on NAFTA, of course. That's a much broader and probably deeper sense of loss when it comes to globalization and the loss of the way things used to be. And I
think you make an essential point, Todd. It's this accumulated sense of grievance from certain social issues. Maybe it's transgender,
right.
Maybe it's gay marriage, maybe it is a job loss. This accumulation becomes a sense of the pendulum's got to swing the other way, and that's what the jubilation is that you're hearing in the votes and the voices of these Trump voters. Lee Snover is someone you had quite a relationship with going back to the summer, and in many ways, and we'll listen to her now, she says it all.
I'm filled with hope. I was feeling so down about America, and I was waiting on someone to come back who wanted to bring America back to mostly manufacturing jobs in a whole new country, in a whole new light. And I didn't know, I wanted it so bad. I had faith from the beginning that Trump was the right candidate, and I really wanted to win Pennsylvania. And I mean, I never stopped believing we could win Pennsylvania. I had some down times. I think the most defeating time I had, or the doubts I had, was after the first debate. But then I saw us bouncing back. I saw the volunteers. I knew there was a movement. I knew there was energy.
So what's different here? And let's get away. Let's forget about slogans and make America
right,
great
I
and
agree.
All that.
I agree.
What is different here that a Republican has won Pennsylvania for the first time since 1988 and also has defied every single expectation of pretty much every single professional, conservative or liberal, who
right.
does political science here?
I will tell you what I think is fundamentally different here. It truly wasn't a conservative movement. It wasn't about social issues. I didn't feel that Christian coalition feel. I really felt a populist movement. I felt united movement, an American movement, a kind of made in America feel. I felt that people were coming together, Democrat, Republican. It was not led by the elites. It was not led by the establishment. It really was grassroots and ground up.
Does that help explain why so many people missed the magnitude here on election night of what happened?
Did they miss it or did they refuse to see it? I'm not sure they missed it as much as they refused to see it. I think it was a major denial and refused to accept that really they refused to accept that regular blue collar, everyday working people could have the country again. I don't think they thought we ever could, especially after Obama. I don't think they ever thought we would win again. And that's what I think they refused to believe.
That's Lee Snover, who's Northampton County GOP chair in Pennsylvania, who spoke with Todd Zwillick about a broad sense of the pendulum's gone too far. It's got to swing back. Is that how you're feeling hours after spending time with Lee Snover and, looking forward there in Pennsylvania, Todd?
You know, one of the things that struck me about Lee, who really had a big victory here, I just want to say about on the political side for Lee Snover, she was an early Trump supporter from the beginning. A lot of people in the Pennsylvania GOP were not there when she was. And Northampton County, where I am right now in Easton, turned from blue to red, John, for the first time since 1988. This is a massive political victory for people like Lee Snover. Now, you heard the way she talked about jobs and the economy and the America of the white working class. And what's interesting about somebody like Lee, for me, in that way, is that when I bring up other issues in this campaign, like sexual assault or like talking about women in a misogynistic or dismissive way or Islamophobia or xenophobia, these things are not things that Lee Snover really connects to. At all. She doesn't say she supports those things. She kind of glosses by them and says either that's campaign rhetoric or just something that gets said in a campaign, I'm really about jobs. So for somebody like her, it really is about economics. Now, she also doesn't speak out against those things that I mentioned. So that might be something to think about as well. And I think something that we're all going to be thinking about as the Trump presidency ramps up. What does acceptance of these things mean, even if there's not outright support for them? And I think that somebody like Lee Snover is somebody who embodies that.
Trumpism, what is it? Is it just the economy stupid, or is it a lot more and a lot darker ideas? We'll find out. Todd Zwillick is with us. Kelly Goff, host of WNYC's Political Party and columnist at The Daily Beast. This is The Takeaway. So since when did non-college-educated white Americans living in gutted communities that have been suffering for years and who missed out on the tepid recovery of the Obama years, since when did they become invisible to college-educated political strategists of both parties? How do you miss 48% of the electorate? Donald Trump spoke to an America that has been frustrated and angry for a long time, but in this election showed itself to represent an electoral majority. In many ways, the joy and excitement that Barack Obama inspired among African Americans and liberals weary of George W. Bush and war in 2008 was matched or exceeded by the anger and fighting spirit of a middle class that sees Donald Trump as some kind of economic messiah for now. Alexander Zaychek spent much of the past year speaking with Trump supporters in different parts of the USA. He's the author of The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America, and he joins me now. Alex, there are a lot of happy people out there, and you know who they are.
I was at a rally in southwestern Pennsylvania on Sunday night, and I was shocked by the sort of celebratory tone. You got the sense almost that they knew something everybody else didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a feeling I had over the course of reporting this book during the primary as well.
And the they is a white, largely not college-educated, middle-class population that essentially consists of rural America from coast to coast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty good description. It was non-college educated whites that put Trump over the top. Those were where he saw his biggest gains. Although, of course, there were also middle class and even upper middle class supporters and people that voted for him, which is how you got this average income of $72,000 that was often thrown around in the media as some kind of proof that this wasn't really a lower class or working class phenomenon. And therefore, it was just really about race. It wasn't economic anxiety.
And again, none of this is, you know, hidden in some vault. I mean, you were able to see this in almost every community that you visited, which raises the question, so how does a bunch of college-educated Democrat liberals miss, you know, half of America that's bleeding out of the aorta?
That's a great question, but I don't think it's a very hard one. I think a lot of people who were pontificating on the average Trump supporter, quote-unquote, didn't get out of that bubble very much. They tended to be Acela corridor types. And, you know, obviously the National Press Corps got out and they did a lot of meet the Trump voter type profiles. But these often were very superficial. I think overall there could have been a lot more attempt to actually understand what was happening in these places. And generally speaking, the pundits, the political class, they don't live there. And it was in their interest to present a superficial reading of it as just racism, because then it lets everybody off the hook and everyone can sort of go into this dismissive gladiatorial pose.
Think in your mind of the ugliest, most deindustrialized community that you visited. And there's probably a number of them that you could, but just give me a name of one.
Well, West Allis, Wisconsin.
West Allis, Wisconsin. Okay. So how long of a clock do you think the West Allis, Wisconsin voters are going to give this president-elect Donald Trump to do something that's going to bring money, jobs, a factory back to their community? Or are they going to be patient with him? I don't understand how quickly they need to be redressed before they move on.
They would say, as long as it seems that he has the forgotten man and the forgotten woman, as he put it in his speech, at the forefront of his policies and attention, then they'd probably give him a certain amount of time. However, I think that they have reason to be worried if they've been paying attention. I mean, Donald Trump has surrounded himself by Goldman Sachs alums and sort of small government, traditional fiscally conservative, let's say, Republican types, and his economic populist rhetoric. We'll find out when he starts making appointments how serious he is about that stuff. I mean, he never really presented much of a serious plan for bringing back some kind of golden age of American industry. I mean, the golden age of American industry was one of labor power, and he offered a sort of top-down, very paternalistic, you know, model of, I'm just going to call up the CEO of Carrier Air Conditioners and yell
and get
at him.
That factory back.
Yeah, that's not how it works.
Right. So then the question becomes, if they don't get what they want right away and they continue to be angry, the only short-term thing that Donald Trump can do is cause pain to people that these folks believe have benefited while they've suffered. And that could be racist. I mean, if Donald Trump says, all right, we're turning the screws on X, Y, and Z community that's receiving all this welfare, you know, that could bide him some time with the folks in West Allis.
Right. I mean,
and that could really divide America.
And that's the danger. And that's why his sort of brand of populism is toxic, dangerous, and ultimately fake, because, you know, it's a cross racial bringing of people together that's really going to lift all boats. And we've seen that in our history at different moments, different populist moments in our past. And I think what's going to have to happen is the Democrats are going to have to come out of this very different, and that will happen. I mean, I think one of the things that happened last night is that the neoliberal Clintonite Democratic Party died and it's not coming back. So the question is, how do we build a new Democratic Party that can appeal to – I don't think we're ever going to talk to all of the Trump supporters, but I do think there's a significant chunk that can be brought in to a much more kind of American, inclusive, pro-science populist politics. And I met a lot of them in the primary states. A lot of people gave Bernie Sanders a very close listen.
Alexander Zaychuk is author of The Gilded Rage, A Wild Ride Through Donald Trump's America. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Takeaway, I'm John Huckenberry with Kelly Goff, host of WNYC's Political Party and columnist at The Daily Beast. What do you think of that was just spoken about there, that if Trump, maybe he isn't an overt racist, but if he can't do anything to help this angry white group that helped to get him elected, he can turn the screws on the people they think have benefited, blacks, Latinos, etc., and that would raise the tensions in a sort of populist Trump administration. What do you think about that?
I think it's interesting. I want to be clear, though. I think that, yes, obviously he won the angry white guy vote, but I don't buy that all of them are angry because they're white. I just want to keep reinforcing that. I think some of them have legitimate reasons to be angry that have nothing to do with race, but a lot of them are angry because of race. How do we know that, John? Because we know that hate groups were coming down membership in terms of since 2011, and we've seen them spike up in the last in the months of this campaign. So that tells us something right there. I do think that what's going to happen is he's someone who's going to find a tough reality in not being able to deliver on a lot of the promises he's made to this group. I think they're going to get disenchanted pretty quickly. And I think we could actually see some really interesting movement in midterms 2 years from now. That's what I actually think is we should be talking about.
No, and I think we will be talking about that between now and the midterms, which are all of a sudden on the table. Zach Stanton joins us, digital editor for Politico magazine. Hey, Zach, in terms of ballot measures in America, it's the day of marijuana.
It absolutely is, yeah. There were some major gains for marijuana yesterday. California, Nevada, Massachusetts all voted to legalize it for recreational purposes. And then in addition to that, it swept the board in terms of the states where it was up for medicinal purposes. Arkansas, Florida, Montana, and North Dakota all look to have legalized it for medicinal purposes, which brings it up to 29 states now where it's legal for medical.
Zach, is it the case that California voters went into the voting booth and were asked to vote yes or no on whether porn actors should wear condoms or not?
It was. It was actually sort of a continuation out of a countywide bill that had passed in Los Angeles County back in 2012. And it was basically making it statewide, this rule that actors in porn films should be forced to wear condoms. And voters overwhelmingly, it looks like, rejected the proposal. Which is a boon to the adult film industry, which was afraid that if the law passed, many of its jobs would go out of state.
There was an AIDS outbreak, though, which is part of why there had been an outbreak
absolutely.
Of STDs, which is part of why they passed. Yeah, I wrote about porn once.
It's definitely an issue.
Get on the table.
death penalty. What happened there?
So the death penalty, not a good night for moratorium advocates. California voted to retain the death penalty. Nebraska voted to retain the death penalty. And Oklahoma actually passed a constitutional amendment to enshrine the right to use the death penalty. Death penalty opponents had been looking at this as a potential high watermark. If California and Nebraska had passed their bans, it would have led to 21 states banning the death penalty, which would have been an all-time high. But it looks like a major setback this morning.
Kelly, you think that's a law and order pivot quickly?
I think a lot of Trump supporters probably support the death penalty is what I'll say about that.
Hmm. Zach, final thoughts?
Final thoughts is that it really ran the board in terms of surprising things. You know, good night for marijuana. Bad night for a lot of the healthcare reforms on the ballot. You know, Colorado had a single payer initiative.
That's right.
It overwhelmingly looks like it lost with about 80% of people opposed to it.
Reversals everywhere you look, but except for marijuana. Zach Stanton is digital editor for Politico magazine. Thanks so much, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
Moving right along, Theo Meyer is with us, reporter for Politico, who covers the House and Senate. Theo, no more divided government in America. Free at last. Is that what the Republicans are saying?
Yes. Republicans now control both the House and the Senate for the first time in a while.
Since the Bush years. I mean, since really the George W. Bush years. But it seems to me that this comes with a kind of strange mandate that is reminiscent of 1980 and the Reagan years. I don't know if you were around for that, but give us a sense of what these races mean and what you were looking at last night.
So Senate races were, for the most part, a disaster for Democrats who were hoping to pick up the four, you know, five or even six seats. They needed four to retake the Senate if Clinton had won the presidency and five if Trump had won. But Democrats only picked up one seat in Illinois. Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth was widely expected to defeat Republican Senator Mark Kirk. They lost two crucial races that they had been expected to win, or at least favorites to win, in Pennsylvania, where Republican Senator Pat Toomey won a close race, and even in Wisconsin, where Republican Senator Ron Johnson was considered sort of a lost cause even by his own party just weeks ago.
So, Theo, Obamacare repeal, is that a done deal?
Well, I think that's sort of unclear at this point. I'm not sure that anyone in either party expected to have a unified Republican government coming in next year. So I think it's still very, very unclear what, you know, everything looks like from a policy standpoint in Congress.
And as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, there are huge implications for the court because of what's happened to the Senate, right?
Yeah, Democrats thought, you know, earlier this year when Republicans blockaded them on the Supreme Court, that they would be able to use this issue successfully in the elections this fall. Not only did that not happen, but the gambit appears to have paid off for Republicans. They successfully resisted, you know, Democratic push to get someone on the court. Republicans can basically do what they want at this point, and it seems, at least in the short term, to have validated a strategy that a lot of people had criticized earlier this year.
As you look down the ballots from state to state, county to county, district to district, is this a Trump coattails phenomenon here, or is it just too granular, too individual in different localities to make a judgment like that?
Well, if you look at the House, for instance, Democrats did not have a good night, but the returns were pretty much in line with, you know, the kind of night that Hillary Clinton was having. Democrats, you know, are going to net fewer than 10 seats in the House, which is not great for them. But they did have a few bright spots. They knocked out some, you know, long-serving Republican incumbents in Florida, in New Hampshire, in New Jersey, in Illinois. Even though Democrats did not have a great night, they did not do perhaps as badly as they could have done in a worst-case scenario.
But worst-case scenario, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House?
On the one hand, he you know, was very successful in limiting Republican losses in the House. On the other hand, he is dealing with something that he probably never expected to deal with in having a President Donald Trump. So his future seems, you know, at this point, completely unclear.
He never expected to be Speaker of the House either. Theo Meyer, reporter for Politico, covering House and Senate races in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly, what do you think about Paul Ryan? Toast?
I'm sad because I think people like him and Mitt Romney tried to say the right things at the right times about certain really racist or inappropriate things Trump said, and they're being punished. And I think that's a sad statement.
Well, we don't know yet, but will he be punished? You expect him to be punished?
Trump sounded pretty vindictive, right? Like, I mean, there's hints that that's his wiring. So I don't see a kumbaya moment happening between them.
House of Cards in Washington, D.C. with Donald Trump at the top.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This result for Donald Trump is being described as a gigantic upset, but is it? Maybe the problem is in the way voters' preferences are measured. Polling and big data aggregators are all scraping the egg off their faces today. The New York Times had Clinton with an 85% chance of winning. 538 predicted 71.4%. What does that mean? And the Princeton Election Consortium predicted around 99.9%. Sam Wong is a neuroscientist and data analyst at Princeton University who co-founded the consortium. He joined us a few days ago to talk about that very high number. He's back with us. Sam, what the heck happened?
Well, let's see. I think that if you're asking me the question, then you're asking what happened with prediction and polling. And to take it at that level, what happened is about a 4 percentage point error in polls and state polls, national polls, Senate polls. And so it appears not just for Trump, but for Republicans in general, there was a hidden bonus that is larger than any bonus that has been seen in recent election cycles. And so what happened there was that there is some vein of Trump voters and Republican voters that was not captured by opinion polling in this year's election cycle.
Which suggests, you know, partly that, you know, Trump is an unusual character, but it also reflects, and you're a scientist, there is error accumulating in yes. the polling process that you folks have not been able to deal with. And it's both the elasticity of what people tell you and the invisibility of other people whose actions become decisive. What are you going to do about that?
If you're asking me as a scientist, then I think the question is, okay, if we want to fix polling, then one thing to do would be to find a way to identify the preferences of these undecided voters, because if you stop and think about it, it's a little mind-bending that someone is likely to vote yet unable to state a preference. And so if there was some way to tease out that hidden preference, then I think that would be one possible way, and that would be a good experiment to do to see if that could be used to repair polling.
Sam, is there a question here about methodology? I know that one of the things that I've been watching for a couple of years since I co-authored a poll for my first book is the connection between class status, race, and people being reachable, right? So I know that the data, yeah. the research has shown that low-income minority voters are often harder to poll for that very reason. They don't have landlines. They're more transient. That's one of the reasons people were shocked by African-Americans outvoting other groups for Obama in 2012. Is there a possibility that the same problem in terms of polling applies to lower income whites, and that is why this chunk of voters got missed? Is that something we're going to look
at? In the other direction where they're hard to reach and yet went out to vote. Is that what you mean by that?
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that is entirely possible. So I think that one thing that's going to come out as people drill into exit polls, since I am not a pollster, I don't have access to the models that pollsters have. And so this is easily answerable by simply drilling into exit polling data, which itself has some issues of sampling, but basically comparing the pattern of who voted and asking the question of how well or poorly that matches with likely voter models. And so that, yes, another possibility is that the demographics that seem to have been pretty strong for Trump all along are whites who didn't go to college and white evangelicals. And so these are groups of voters, one that you've mentioned, and we can ask the question of whether they were missed somehow simply because they were not reachable by, say, landline, cell phone, or email.
Sam, I'm telling you, I love you, but I really feel as though there's a much bigger transformation going on here, and that is in the era of social media, people are used to playing different roles, changing their identity, saying things to just try stuff out. And I don't see why there's any reason you would expect anything people say to pollsters to be honest. I mean, it's a garbage in, garbage out kind of situation. And as far as your argument that Donald Trump doesn't behave like other candidates, so that explains this, that means if you run a chimp for president, he's more likely to win because the pollsters will miss the chimpness of him or something. I don't know. It's very puzzling.
Yeah, so you know, can this be fixed with a Band-Aid by just simply coming up with better ways to interview people through polls? I mean, right. So let's say we were to pitch the whole polling idea and just go in some totally different direction. A possibility would be to use hidden preferences. So, for instance, one of my readers at the Princeton Election Consortium did some calculations and showed that Google search terms on completely other subjects having nothing to do with political preference could be used to learn something about the demographics of, say, Trump preference or Kasich preference or Cruz preference. And so basically using statistical learning and using the giant amounts of data available to Google, she was able to infer levels of support for candidates. And so one possibility, if it's important to us as a community, as a nation, to know in advance what people's preferences are, then one way to do it would be to just do a total end run around the concept of polling and find other ways to measure how it is that people feel about who they're going to vote for.
Thanks so much for talking to us today and on all the times that we've gotten instructive insights from you, Sam.
Thanks a lot.
Sam Wong is a neuroscientist at Princeton University and a data analyst and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. We're going to conclude this hour with a conversation with Gloria Steinem, founder of the National Women's Political Caucus, who created Ms. Magazine, powerful voice of progressive feminism for decades. Gloria Steinem joins me now. Welcome, Gloria.
Thank you so much.
What are your thoughts after this really extraordinary two-year period and one amazing night?
Very hard to put them together, but I feel as if this is a vote against the future, and the future is going to happen anyway. It's something that's happening in other countries as well, obviously, with Brexit. It's happening even in India, where a very right-wing chief of state is now present, a Hindu fascist, as they refer to him. And it does feel like a vote against the social justice movements that have made so much change and actually changed the majority opinion, and against the insecurity of borders these days and change in general. It's, you know, I understand it. It makes me very sad. I think it's doomed to failure, but it's very powerful right now.
When you say you understand it, what does that mean?
Well, for instance, every once in a while a man will say to me, a black woman took my job. Mm. Now, probably that's a Trump voter. And I say to him, but who said it was your job? You know, it's a sense of entitlement that he has, that he was brought up with, that he deeply believes. And it's going away, you know, because it's in about 20 minutes, this country is no longer going to be a majority white country. Will be majority many different nationalities and people of color. And that seems to me kind of great. You know, we're going to understand other countries better. It's going to be a more interesting culture. We're going to have better food. You know, I mean, but to him, it feels profoundly threatening because he was raised to believe he had a place in a hierarchy that was inevitable.
Is it wrong of the Democratic Party to have left all those people in the lurch on some level and not offered something for them and left this big opening for Donald Trump?
You know, I'm not sure that we can take responsibility for bias because it is a white lash. You know, the people who were so profoundly against President Obama that I often thought if they had cancer and he had the cure, they wouldn't accept it. So there, you know, there is a very deep bias there. However, it's also true that there's economic suffering, and I think that polarization is something we are responsible for.
Following up on John's question, Gloria, do you think, though, perhaps that, you know, with the perfect analogy you opened with, that the white man believes a black woman took his job, obviously not realizing that we African-American women still make substantially less on the dollar than they do, or white women, but that's a separate conversation. But do you think that there wasn't enough clarification, perhaps, by the Clinton campaign that, yes, you're suffering economically, but you're blaming the wrong person? Because I did hear that last night from people who felt they didn't effectively enough make that distinction specifically to that group of people.
You know, I'm not sure that that would have worked because it's abstract. But I think what might have been helpful is to focus more on the kinds of jobs that men with high school educations and skills that are very important would be interested in. I mean, a lot of the jobs that they see coming up are jobs they don't want because they're in healthcare. They're in what's called the pink collar ghetto. It's mostly female and therefore to them feminine area of work. But what we need is to repair and reconstruct the infrastructure in this country. So we need a program like in the Depression, you know, we need the WPA again. And if we had focused on that. And indeed, Hillary Clinton was supporting a huge program of repair to the infrastructure, then they might have seen the kind of jobs that appeal to them and that they can do. And we didn't do that enough.
But I'm wondering if Hillary Clinton played into a kind of Clarence Thomas narrative where she focused way too much on these tapes and abusive language moments of Donald Trump and not enough on that infrastructure, I can bring the jobs back message. And that ultimately, Americans who are hurting basically said, it doesn't matter that much to me. You know what I mean? Get me a job.
Well, it's a very gendered division that you're talking about, because the tapes mattered to way more to women than to men. They did to many men, too. And, you know, lots of people came forward, athletes came forward and said, not in my locker room, you know. So it wasn't simply something that shocked women. But we must remember that it's also a deep bias that exists against women. And there's not a lot we can do about that except understand it and reach out and so on, but it isn't something that we can change.
Gloria, can I ask a question about, there's a lot of conversation about Hillary running as a woman and how much she struggled with whether or not to make that a key portion of her campaign. And I wanted to ask about the fact that it was not until the last debate that we finally heard a substantive question on reproductive rights. Ms. Magazine famously ran the groundbreaking feature in which women shared that they'd had abortions. And I'm wondering what you believe happened to the conversation around reproductive rights now in the courts.
It was not a question asked in any of the debates, I believe.
To the last
and,
one.
Oh, yes, court. Right, in the very last one. But, I agree with you that that is perceived as a side issue as opposed to a fundamental issue. I mean, the way that we begin hierarchies is controlling reproduction, and that means controlling the bodies of women. And, of course, if there is a strong racist system or a caste system, as in India, then it becomes even more vital to control reproduction, because that's the only way you can maintain the separation of groups that racism or a caste system or a class system requires. So those things are intertwined and they're fundamental, but they are still viewed as a kind of side issue. One example that I think is very striking is that when you look at the predictors of whether a country will be violent within itself or whether it will be willing to use military violence against another country, the strongest predictor is not poverty or access to natural resources or religion or even degree of democracy. It's violence against females, because that's what we see first in the home, or at least control or dominance of females. It normalizes the idea that one group is born to dictate to another. And yet that is not mentioned in our foreign policy usually. I mean, Hillary Clinton did it more than most, but, well, she probably was the first person to do it at all. But it is not viewed as important. Do you remember the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who then turned into the Taliban? They were kind of the fathers of
sure.
the Taliban.
Yeah.
They explained why they were against the more secular government in Afghanistan. They said, we're going to war because, one, girls are being allowed to go to school. Two, women have to give their permission to get married. And three, women can come to political meetings. And I remember those headlines in the Washington Post. And we happened to have some meeting in the State Department at the time, which was about something completely different. I mean, I'd forgotten what it was. And I remember standing up in the auditorium and saying, we're on the wrong side. And people laughed. You know, they, I mean, the State Department officials thought it was such an extraneous thing to say that they just laughed. But it's not an extraneous thing to say. And we have not taken that into consideration as a kind of root normalization of dominance and violence.
You said on this program, and you thought very hard about it, and I remember very clearly, you said Bernie Sanders and his program are diagnostic. Hillary Clinton is curative. Now, that says to me that maybe you believe that on some level Hillary Clinton is a flawed candidate. What do you think now?
No, I was just thinking about practical action. Here's an example. I mean, Bernie Sanders was very importantly talking about free universal education. And, of course, for everybody graduating in huge debt, which is enormously unfair, that had a great appeal. When Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders got together, it became more practical because Hillary said, you know, there maybe rich people should pay something for education. And it became, instead of free universal education, debt-free education. So families with an income of over $125,000 a year were, you know, the beginning level for paying for education. So I just meant in a sheer, so she made it practical. Does that make sense?
Right, but if you can't win, it's not practical.
No, but if you – he couldn't win, you know, because free universal education is not in control of the president, and it also was not fundamentally fair. It was a winning position. Whether or not she was a winning candidate, it was a winning position.
But Donald Trump can't restore white privilege, and he can't restore, or at least for the middle-class, angry male voters who voted for him, he can't restore that. He can't make America great again. He can't bring the jobs back to rural Wisconsin. But that was a winning position.
It's a promise. It's a promise of return to the past, which is not possible, but it's very appealing.
Let me ask you one.
It's returning to a past that felt that had a more natural hierarchy in their view.
One last question, because we have to go here, Kelly, you can weigh in if you want as well. You say this is going back to the past, and I understand what you're saying, but it's also possible. I'm wondering if. If this huge turnout of rural white voters who were so convinced of their privilege and who are now understanding that, no, they don't have it anymore and they have to fight for something, maybe it's not going back to the past, but it is the present. They've won for now, but essentially over the next 4 years, we have a much more candid engagement on issues of economic justice. And, everybody's out of the woodwork right now. And that's the way change happens. Trump isn't particularly attractive to a lot of people in America, but that's how things work. It's not the past. It's the present. What do you think?
It's going to slow down the change. I agree. But in terms of the changes in the country, the first generation of babies who are majority babies of color have already been born, regardless of their ability to stop immigration or slow immigration or to do away with family planning and so on. I mean, you know, this people look you in the eye and say the white race is committing suicide through contraception and abortion. I mean, they really believe that. But the fact is that they can slow change and they can make it much more painful. But it's inexorable. I mean, we are going to change. We should always reach out to each other and tell each other our stories and our concerns and try to find all kinds of ways in which we can work together, and I believe that we can do that. But it is, I don't think we can reverse course completely. I think this will slow progress.
I have to say, Gloria, I actually interviewed Gordon Baum, the white supremacist who's now deceased, in one of my last interviews with him by phone. He didn't actually know what I looked like or that I was African-American. He mentioned his concerns about white women not having enough babies. And that was actually one of his major concerns a few years ago. Can I ask you, Gloria, is there any sign of hope for you in terms of the issues you care about that you take away?
Yes, you. You're my sign of hope, right? I've seen so much. One advantage of being old, I have to say, is that you remember when it was worse, way, way, way worse. It's frustrating, it's sad, it's tragic, but most of the issues I care about, and I think probably the three of us mostly care about, are now majority issues in public opinion polls, and they didn't even exist as phrases when I was in college or getting out of college. So consciousness is changing. The idea of possibilities are changing. From understanding that marriage and love and connection happens between two women and two men, to understanding that, I would say in general, what we are figuring out, and what incidentally I think we knew for most of human history before colonialism and a whole bunch of other stuff, is that human beings are linked. We are not ranked. That the paradigm of society is a circle, not a pyramid. And the cultures that were here before Columbus showed up were built on that principle. We're enormously sophisticated cultures. And in fact, our Constitution is based on the Iroquois Confederacy.
Yeah, I love that.
And Marx and Engels read a book about the Iroquois Confederacy. It's where they got their idea of communism. I mean, they made one big error, it turns out, in retrospect, which is that they said that the end justifies the means. And the whole principle of this culture was that the means should reflect the ends you want as much as possible.
Well, the fact that Americans are coming to grips with their history in a candid, real consciousness way, I think is a fabulous takeaway from this era, if not this campaign. Mm-hmm. Final question, Gloria Steinem. Is Donald J. Trump your president?
No. No, he's not. I'm not going to disobey the law, but I'm not going to pretend he represents me.
Gloria Steinem, feminist, social, and political activist, and, anyway, your name speaks for itself. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you for the companionship on this morning. Thank you.
Anybody else need companionship?
Hi, my name is Mary Klein. I'm calling from Livonia, Michigan. Basically, I'm terrified for my family, for myself, and every person that doesn't fit into Trump's world of racism, misogyny, and hate. He's given license to hate, and I don't even know what to feel. I can't even breathe.
My thanks to Kelly Goff, host of WNYC's Political Party and columnist at The Daily Beast. It's been great having you here.
Thanks for having me, John. It was fun.
Absolutely. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. If you want to be a part of the conversation, tweet us at The Takeaway. And join us tonight for a live call-in show we're calling The Road Forward. Todd Zwillick is hosting and taking your calls all night. It starts at 8 p.m. Eastern, and you can find it streaming live at PRI.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.